This is an ABC podcast.
On RN, you're with The Myths of War, an eight-part series exploring Australia's war history and what's fact and what's not, with historian and writer Mark Dappin.
Japan has won the war! Japan has won! Go to your barracks at once! In the morning, you all will die! Elements outside barracks will be shot!
Hi, I'm Dr. Mark Dappin, and that was a clip from the 2001 ABC TV drama Changi, written by the great John Doyle, one of my favourite writers. And here am I, not in Changi, but in the office of one of my favourite historians, Professor Peter Stanley at UNSW Canberra. The popular idea of Changi is as a hell camp, a Japanese concentration camp. Is this a reasonable picture?
Changi was not a hellhole. It wasn't pleasant. But one of the marked things about Changi is that the prisoners rarely saw the Japanese directly, contrary to that 2001 drama series you mentioned. So you could go for months in Changi without seeing a Japanese guard. And in many ways, the prisoners were self-governing. Mind you, it wasn't a nice place to be, but it was the best of the worst.
Would anybody have died from brutality in Changi?
Men were executed in Changi. There was the terrible example in 1942, soon after they went into captivity, where they didn't quite understand the way the Japanese ran the place, where a number of men tried to escape and, of course, were apprehended and were executed. So although there was random brutality, because Japanese guards could never be relied upon to behave the same way, they rarely saw the Japanese, and so men were not tortured or brutalized in Changi routinely, but there were exceptional cases, and that everyone knew the boundaries of Japanese rule.
How has our picture of life in Changi specifically changed over the years? How is it seen at the end of the Second World War compared to the way we look at it now?
Although Australians are obsessed with their military history, there are aspects which have eroded in public knowledge, and I think POWs of the Japanese is one of them. You know, in 1947, if you went into the main street and said, what do you know about Sandakan, or what do you know about Kuching, or what do you know about Japan, people would be able to tell you that this place is different to that place. Well, 70-odd years on, that knowledge is eroded. So now the word Changi has come to encompass the whole prisoner of war experience. And a lot of people, I'm sure, think that the Burma-Thailand Railway was somewhere near Changi. You know, they have no concept that it was actually several hundred miles away, and it was a completely different setting. And that television drama from 2001 has not helped in this, because it was called Changi, but it was actually a completely fictitious, an imaginary, an exaggerated portrayal of the POW experience. So as time goes on, people know less and less about the specifics.
The story of Allied prisoners of war in Southeast Asia starts at Changi in eastern Singapore, where about 87,000 defeated soldiers were held after the Japanese invasions of Malaya, Singapore and the Dutch East Indies. Fortress Singapore was supposed to hold off any Japanese advance towards Australia and deny the Japanese Navy command of the sea.
Britain's far-sighted leaders for generations have maintained strong forces at the Empire's strategic crossroads. But Singapore's real greatness is its link in the chain of Empire's strength and communications. On land, air and sea, Singapore's units are symbols of an empire that is as free as the air and as permanent as the sun.
When it fell on February the 15th, 1942, after only 70 days of fighting in the Malay Peninsula, Winston Churchill called it the worst disaster in British military history. The British commander, Lieutenant General Arthur Percival, unconditionally surrendered on behalf of all Allied troops, and nearly 15,000 Australians, the majority of whom had never fired a shot, were captured. The entire 8th Division, a host of Alfs and Berts and big men called Tiny and redheads named Blue, disappeared behind barbed wire. The Japanese had never planned to take so many prisoners, and at first they had no idea what to do with them, so they simply herded them into the old British Army barracks near the prison at Changi. Professor Joan Beaumont, Australian National University.
So because it was big and it was established, Changi Barracks was not a place where people died in large numbers. They didn't starve, and wasn't, as it's sometimes depicted, a byword for horror. But for those POWs who had been up on the railway, Changi was almost a heaven when they returned to it, because it was so much better than the conditions they experienced elsewhere. Now, there was another Changi called Changi Prison, and that's just down the road from where the Celebang Barracks are on Singapore. And initially, civilian internees from the island of Singapore were interned in Changi Prison. The POWs are moved there in the middle of 1944, out of the barracks and into the prison. And conditions there were very crowded and uncomfortable and unpleasant. But again, it's not catastrophic in terms of the death rate. So we have to acknowledge that Changi has come to sort of symbolise much more than it actually represented at the time. And it's interesting how the memories have become merged in some ways, because one of the most famous images of POWs is an image of a man who's suffering, I think, cholera. He's very emaciated, being supported by two men who are themselves suffering from malaria or dysentery. And that was a drawing done in one of the worst camps on the Thai-Burma Railway, but it's the image that's used by the Changi Museum today as representing the experience of captivity under the Japanese.
Former POW Stan Arniel was interviewed in 1980 about his 1943 return from the railway to Changi, where he and his party, led by Noel Johnson, were met by the commander of AIF prisoners in Changi, Fred Blackjack Gallahan.
It was most moving. We got back about 1 o'clock in the morning and Blackjack was on the road at Changi. And they pushed us out of the trucks. A couple were dead, and put those down on the side. And it was very good, really, because we were soldiers of Blackjack. And there was no way that we wanted to be shabby. And so we stood up,
yes,
just like soldiers. Some couldn't stand. Blackjack cried. You couldn't take it, because Major Johnson, Blackjack said to him, "Where are the rest?" He said, "This is all there is, sir. The other 200 were dead." But the people at Changi were wonderful. Sir David Griffin was one of them. And they actually were quite shocked. We were like cadavers. Yes. We were like cadavers. And they gave all their little goodies, which they'd saved for Christmas, to us. We didn't even know. But it was great to be back. Wonderful times there at Changi. Music, conversation, books. It was absolutely fantastic. I enjoyed every minute of it.
Well, he did 2 years in Changi in the big Pacific War. He'd been to hell and back again. Somehow came through it all. His most prized possession was the banjo that he made. As he built it all around him, he watched his comrades fall.
I'm joined now by Dr. Lachlan Grant, senior historian at the Australian War Memorial and editor of the Changi Book, a collection of wartime essays by Changi POWs.
There were a few executions that took place, and these were prisoners who were caught escaping. But by and large, the prisoners of war in Changi are so outnumbered the Japanese guards. Some prisoners say they rarely even saw Japanese guard during their time there. And even one of the extraordinary things about Chang is much of the law and order in the camp was actually done by the Australian and British soldiers, officers themselves. So they were kind of looked after by their own. And in that early period of Changi, in 1942, there's not even they refer to it as a token wire that marks the boundary of the camp. And they basically say to the men, don't go beyond this wire, otherwise you'll be in trouble with the Japanese. But there's no watchtowers, high barbed wire fences, you know, the kinds of things we think of a prisoner of war camp. It's really a corner of Singapore that's just cordoned off, and they say, don't leave the area.
Famously, Changi was the scene of regular concert parties in which men sang, danced, and often dressed up as women. And when former POWs were first interviewed after the war, these shows loomed large in their memories, or at least in the memories they were prepared to share.
We're waiting for something to happen.
All Army concert parties, they all had female impersonators, and they were always a big joke. I mean, every time a guy came on and dressed, it was a big joke, and they'd yell and say, oh, look at you, and all that kind of stuff. But gradually, as the time went by, they became more and more conscientious about their makeup, and they would not burlesque the thing. And after a while, you looked upon them as women, you know. You knew they weren't, but the particular show that they'd be in, you'd say, well, that's the girl, you know, and you wouldn't laugh at her when she came on because she would look rather attractive.
In the immediate post-war years, drag was generally considered just a bit of vaguely risque fun. But is it worth re-examining the evidence through a more contemporary perspective? That is, was there a true transgender scene in Changi? Or, for that matter, any kind of gay life?
Although sex wasn't talked about, and I refer to the later years rather than the early, obviously in the early stages very much thought of because it was just cut off very suddenly. And the boys were still very healthy. In fact, one of my jobs to go in at night time, because certain couples of men were known to be going to certain little spots, indulging in homosexuality. And I was supposed to go along and break it up or prevent it or, you know, tell them to get back to their separate bunks and huts, etc. On one occasion, it seemed to be getting so bad that the officers went to the Japanese and asked them would they give the soldiers some trenches to dig, great long trenches. And so they dug those, and nobody's told what it was for. In actual fact, the reason they were asked is to get rid of some of their energy, because others had to fill them up within a week or so, and they'd dig more trenches. And this was in an effort to stop this type of business.
Here's Professor Christina Toomey of Monash University, author of the recent award-winning history book, The Battle Within, POWs in Post-War Australia.
Some prison camps were less harsh than others. So I think we have to be realistic that a whole lot of men grouped together in a prison environment are going to have sex with each other. Some of them will. Some of them will.
Now, Russell Braddon, the most famous immediate post-war chronicler of the Japanese POW experience, he was, of course, gay.
But he doesn't mention that at all in his very famous account of the prison camp called The Naked Island. He was most reticent about it in that book.
It's not sort of Naked Island in that sense.
It's a great title for someone who is not talking at all about having been gay in the prison camp. There was a biography of him written by Nigel Stark, and Nigel Stark interviewed a gentleman who'd been in the camp with Russell Braddon, and Nigel Stark was clearly pressing to see if this fellow was aware that Russell Braddon was gay and said, did you know that he was gay? And he said, well, yeah, of course. A lot of chaps who were in the concert parties were gay and they had their partners. And the interviewer pushed and said, well, how did you know? And he said, well, I saw him kissing blokes.
Here's Professor Kevin Blackburn of Nanyang Technical University, Singapore.
Yeah, this idea of captivity and sexuality is quite interesting because James Cavell talks about this in his fictional work, King Rat, in terms of it was a time of liberation in terms of that they could, you know, they could finally, you know, basically come out and perform as females and they would have male admirers.
You're a liar, Stevens. You shave your legs and you're a liar.
Not all of the impersonators were gay or transgender, of course, but even before the Second World War, the British military had bought one variant of British gay life to Changi, that is, upper-class men cruising the streets for rough trade.
When we look at Changi, we see all these interesting areas of Changi that we can't get to, actually. But one of the sites that was really well known was a strip of road called Stanford Road that ran from St. Andrew's Cathedral to the museum today. And this was an area where mainly British officers, but military personnel could actually pick up young Malay men or young Chinese men and take them back for various sexual activities, obviously. This wasn't something that the authorities liked, and historically they had what's called, you know, part of the criminal code called Section 377A, which was meant to stop this type of activity. It was from India, but of course Indian law became incorporated into Singapore law because of the historical connections. So we still have that law today, actually, in Singapore. And yeah, basically the gay community is trying to get rid of it. You look at the experiences of, you know, that time, they have many consequences and many legacies, actually. Yeah.
Before the ABC miniseries Changi, the best-known dramatic representation of POW life in Changi was the American movie of James Clavell's novel King Rat.
I'm not playing at being provost marshal, you know. And I never yet heard of a run of luck that didn't run out. And yours will depend on it, because you're like all criminals, you're greedy.
Now, King Rat is set in the officers' camp at Changi in the last years of the war. As we've heard, some of the more famous photographs of Changi show listless, skeletal men with sunken eyes, dressed in rags like concentration camp survivors, obvious victims of starvation and deprivation. However, the majority of those men lost their health and vigour on the Thai-Burma Railway and actually came to Changi to recover. For those blokes who'd slaved on the hammer and tap in Hellfire Pass, Changi was a place they could put on weight, rest and recuperate. It was only after 1944 that food in Changi itself fell into short supply, and those were the desperate days that formed a backdrop to King Rat. The film caused a bit of controversy when it was released in Australia in 1965 because of its depictions of Australians as the camp's most accomplished criminals and black marketeers.
So the way I figured, you Australian thieves, you only thieves that can supply in bulk. So I tell you what I'm prepared to offer. You supply all the cages we need and market the produce, we'll cut you in for 50% of the action. You interested?
Yeah, that sounds like a proposition. I gotta mention this. I'm not too keen on selling to any cobbers. You know, mates, it just don't seem right, does it?
There was a question tabled in Parliament by the Country Party member for Mallee, Winston George Turnbull, who, like other MPs on both sides of the House, was a former prisoner of the Japanese. He asked,
"Is the film King Rat currently being screened in Australia a true record of events in Changi Prison Camp, Singapore, or a money-making project to the detriment of the reputation of many Australians and others who served in Malaya and who were imprisoned in Changi?"
It was as if Canberra was being asked to play the role of a kind of cultural censor, which was not something that happened in response to the film in other parts of the world. And yet, memory of King Rat is virtually lost in Australia today, although Kevin Blackburn still shows extracts to his students in modern Singapore.
Yeah, so I think King Rat was probably not well served by, in terms of casting and also as a the way it's shot. It's King Rat's shot entirely in black and white as well. It's one of those things where you know, perhaps a great story wasn't told as well in the cinema as what it could have been.
What's it like in Changi today, Kevin?
They renovated the site and they moved it down, you know, the road to where it is today because they were kind of reconstructing the prison, actually. They wanted to turn it into a modern prison because the same prison that was there in 1936 for about 1,000 people was still the same one. And I went into it about two times, actually. They would take visitors every 15th of February. They would take people, mainly veterans and their relatives. And it really wasn't a great place to be if you were a prisoner. So what they did was basically move it down the museum. They moved the museum down while they demolished the prison, which became a controversy in Australia around 2003. As in Britain, they didn't make much noise at all, actually. But in Australia, it was almost like they were demolishing the Australian War Memorial or something like that, actually, because they really, the Australian government, from what I heard informally, really did test its relations with Singapore, actually. The Australian High Commission was very, you know, very kind of vehement about, you know, preservation of it. So the Singapore government, you know, met the Australian government halfway and they preserved one of the walls, you know, as a memorial, and they took away the gate from the side and moved it into the the front, which is not accurate historically, but it was a compromise.
Now, back to Peter Stanley for a few words about the last days of Changi.
Now listen, men. The information that we're getting is that Japan has surrendered. And just how this is welcomed on the ground is another thing. And this will be a long night. I suggest you pray if you're religious. And should we not make it tonight, I want to thank each of you. You've conducted yourselves as men with dignity and courage.
Outside!
At the end of the final episode of the TV drama, Changi, I think a Japanese goes wild murdering prisoners in Changi. In fact, that's not quite what occurred, is it?
It certainly isn't what happened in Changi. Because it was a large and very orderly camp, the transition of power, if you like, was orderly. The Japanese absented themselves and the prisoners took over. The existing prison command structure took over. So there wasn't any riot or disorder or murders in Singapore. But there were other places where prisoners were murdered. I mean, the most extreme example is Sandakan in Borneo, where there were 2,500 Allied prisoners of war, British and Australian, on the Sandakan Death March, and aptly named, because at the end of the war there were only six survivors, all Australians, all of whom had escaped from the Death March. So the Japanese, and again, the Japanese behaviour in the Pacific War wasn't consistent. It wasn't as all Japanese did one thing and all Japanese did something else. That they would behave differently depending on the situation, even the personality of the camp commandant, his interpretation of the rules or the orders that he'd received. So in Singapore, it was an orderly transition. In other places, it was chaotic. In other places, the Japanese retained control until it was wrested off them by the relief parties.
So for many prisoners, the end of the war was marked with death marches and massacres. But Changi itself was never any kind of a death camp. Many prisoners of Changi suffered terribly during the war, but usually on the Thai-Burma Railway, or in other places rather than Changi itself. As for what really happened on the railway, you're going to have to wait another episode to find out. I'd like to thank my guests, Professor Peter Stanley of the Australian Centre for the Study of Armed Conflicts and Society, UNSW Canberra, Professor Joan Beaumont of the Strategic and Defence Studies Centre at the ANU, Lachlan Grant, Senior Historian at the Australian War Memorial and editor of the Changi Book of Wartime Essays by Changi POWs, Professor Christina Toomey of Monash University, author of the recent award-winning history book The Battle Within, POWs in Post-War Australia, and Professor Kevin Blackburn of Nanyang Technical University, Singapore. Next time, I ask, was there really a battle for Australia? And I answer, probably not, mate, nah. I'm Mark Dappin, see ya.
For the first time in her history, the grim tide of war flows to Australia's shores. The threat of a Japanese attack on the Commonwealth, which Australians had long spoken about, has now become reality. For the first time in 150 years, the Great Island continent is under direct threat of invasion.
You've been listening to The Myths of War with historian and writer Mark Dappin. You can listen back or download all 8 programs in this series. You'll find them on the RN homepage or via the ABC Listen app.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.